Hello again, this is Thelma English, and I'm going to be reading to you from Book 5 of Virgil's Aeneid. I'm reading from the Robert Fitzgerald translation. You need to have your copy handy, and you can follow along in Book 5. Book 5 comes right on the heels of Book 4, which it was very emotionally draining. This book, Book 5, is filled with the anniversary games for Aeneas' deceased father, Anchises. He died a year earlier, so they're going to have all of these Olympic-style games to honor his memory. They're going to have a ship race, a foot race, some archery, boxing. They'll even have a parade to entertain the men. Lots of similarities here in these funeral games for Anchises, as for Patroclus and Iliad, Book 23, that was presided over by Achilles, or the games in Odyssey, Book 8, where Odysseus is actually competing in games. After this intensity of Dido, Ulysses' dramatic suicide, the book kind of provides a rest for us, the audience, because there's such an intensity in Book 4, and intensity is coming again in Book 6 as we enter the last half of the book, which is war. And so this chapter 5, Book 5, provides us with a little bit of a relief. And we get our faith renewed in Aeneas as a leader, and he shows his quality as he manages the games. We feel confident, yes, he can found a new city. And the near disaster of the burning of the ships really tests him. This is the last place that takes place outside of Italy. The rest of our story in Book 6 is going to take place in Italy, and there's lots of warfare and battle, and that is very comparable to the Iliad. Virgil is going to use competitions to highlight individual Trojans. Now, most of these, when Virgil is reading the story out loud in that first century BC, just before, about, 15 years before the birth of Christ, when Virgil dies and this is published, these are well-known family names. So these people are listening to their own family names as though they have forefathers 1,000 years earlier with these same names. So Virgil's audience would note these old family names. They'd be proud of them. Some, especially Nisus and Euryalus in Book 9, are going to figure prominently later in the poem. Pay special attention to Palinurus. He opens Book 5 in virtual command of the fleet. Remember, he's steering the boats, and then he closes it with his dedication to Aeneas, and he also dies. And the grieving Aeneas takes over, and then of the boats. Palinurus, like Dido or Alyssa, is a victim of the gods, and he dies mysteriously, which is just part of being subject to Aeneas' destiny. So we're going to, if you look in your syllabus, page 98, we have a map, and you can see Palinurus and their diversion to Sicily, which is in between Carthage and Italy. So we have this anniversary, the funeral games, ship races, matching, boxing matches, and each of these will have names that will ring true to the audience in that first century BC when Virgil is reading it out loud. And Ascanius is going to lead the young men in these Trojan games, and they're going to have what we call the Troy Parade. And so these equestrian or games with horses suggest justification for the later Roman games that they have, which is during Virgil's own lifetime. So Virgil kind of makes this up, that 1,000 years earlier they played the same games, doing these same things with horses. And in Juno, Hera is going to send Iris to the Trojan women and get them all worked up. And she's disguised as an old woman. This is going to happen at line 781. And the women are going to set fire to the ships in an effort to force the group to quit wandering all around. They want to stay. Four ships get burned before Jupiter, Zeus, sends a rainstorm and puts out the fire. So now, on the advice of Nautes, they decide, okay, now we don't have enough ships for everybody. They're going to leave the old and the weak in Sicily with Acestes. That gets rid of almost all of the women very conveniently. Now the Trojans are going to go to Italy, and they are going to need new women. And so that gives them a reason to intermarry with the Italians. Instead of waiting for their sons to grow up, they'll all need wives. And they create this new race of the Latins or the Romans. And that's late in the 900s, Book 5, starting about line 930. We learn this is happening. Then Anchises, who's dead for a year, appears in a dream to Aeneas and says to obey naughties and leave the weary there. Just leave them there. You've got a journey, but you have to go to the underworld. So then Venus, Aeneas's mother, asks Poseidon, Neptune, to provide safe passage for her son. But it is fated that one man still has to die. And so we're going to have the death of Palinurus. Somebody has to die. So the god of sleep overcomes him. He sails too close to the Sirens' rocks, and he falls overboard, and he's gone. And Aeneas has to take the helm, and he has to take the ships all the way to Latium. And that will be Book 5. So let's get started with Book 5. Cutting through waves blown dark by a chill wind, Aeneas held his ships firmly on course for a mid-sea crossing. But he kept his eyes upon the city far astern, now bright with poor Elissa's Dido's pyre. What caused that blaze remained unknown to watchers out at sea. But what they knew of the great love profaned in anguish and a desperate woman's nerve led every Trojan heart into foreboding. So they see, they're out on the ships, and they see the flames back at shore, and they're kind of suspecting the worst, and they're thinking, oh no, you know, what could that big bonfire mean? They probably not a hot dog roast. Line 10. When they had gained the offing, east and north, no land in sight now, but sky everywhere and everywhere the sea, a thunderhead towered above them, bringing gloom and storm with shuddering dusky water. Aeneas's helmmen, Palinurus, called from his high stern deck. Oh, why have these clouds massed on the height of heaven? Father Neptune, what are you brewing for us? On this he made the seamen shorten sail and bend to the oars. He trimmed his fluttering canvas more to catch the wind and said, Aeneas, Lord Commander, even if Jupiter should pledge his word for it, I could not hope to make landfall on Italy in this weather. It's thickening up, and now the wind blows hard out of the musky west abeam of us. No bucking it. We cannot make our northing. Seeing that fortune has the upper hand, I say give in and follow where she calls. No long reach eastward. There's a loyal coast, I think, of the land named for your brother, Eryx, and the Sicilian ports, if I remember rightly my star heights and my miles at sea. The good commander, this is Aeneas, says, for some time now I've noticed that the veering wind demands, and how you fought it uselessly. Change course, haul yards and sails around. Could any soil be more agreeable to me, or any where I would rather moor these tired ships than Sicily, home of my Dardan friend, Acestes? So the king of Sicily is his friend, and the ashes of my father. With this exchange, they headed east for port, the west wind in their sails. On a following swell, the fleet ran free, and happily at last, they turned in toward the shoreline that they knew. Far off now, on a high hilltop, Acestes wondered to see his guests' fleet coming in, then hurried down, spiny with javelins, wearing a Libyan she-bear's hide. Acestes, born of a Trojan mother, to the river god Crinisus, as he knew and prized its parentage, he welcomed their return, treated them to the riches of the fields, and comforted with friendship weary men. When, the next day at dawn, the brightening sky made the stars fade, Aeneas called his crews together from all quarters of the shore, and spoke to them from a built-up rostrum. So Aeneas is speaking from a rostrum. Now the Romans at the time of Virgil, they stand up on a rostrum and speak. It's the same thing. He's kind of inserting 1st century BC Rome into this 1,000 year prior as he's creating history as he goes. And this is the 1 year anniversary. So he says, sons of Dardanus, in the high line of gods, the months are spent, the rounding year fulfilled since we interred my godlike father's bones and mourned and blessed his altars. And if I am not mistaken, now that day has come, which I shall hold in bitterness and honor all my life, gods, you would have it so, were I today exiled in Libyan sands, or caught at sea off Argos, or detained in walled Mycenae, still I should carry out my anniversary vows and ceremonies, heaping the altars as I should with offerings. But now, beyond all expectation, here we stand, beside his ashes and his bones, and surely not, I think, without the great god's will and contrivance, carried here off course to enter kindly havens. Come then, everyone, we'll celebrate this holiday in joy. Let us ask for propitious winds, and when our city is laid out, our temples blessed in father's honor, may he grant each year that I perform this ritual. So he's establishing a Roman holiday. Every year, we're going to do this and have this thing. Trojan-born Acestes gives each ship 2 head of oxen. Welcome the hearth gods to the feast, our own and those of our host Acestes cherishes. Then, too, if we trust 9 days from now, dawn lifts for mortals her dear light and bears the world with sun rays, I shall plan and hold contests for Trojans. First a ship race, then we'll see who wins at running, who stands out in the pride of strength at javelin and archery, or dares to fight with rawhide on his hands. That'd be like boxing, with your hands tied up with not boxing gloves, but rawhide. May all compete for prizes and the palm. Now silence all. Garland your brows with leaves. At this, he shaded his own brows with myrtle, loved by his mother, because you remember that Venus, Aphrodite, myrtle is her plant, loved by his mother. Helemus did the same. Acestes, ripe with age, the boy Ascanius, and all the young men followed suit. Aeneas left the assembly now and made his way with many thousands to the funeral mound, walking amid the crowd. Once there, he poured the ritual libations, two of wine, two of fresh milk, and two of victim's blood, then cast down purple mourning flowers and said, I greet and bless you, sacred father. Bless you, ashes and shade and soul. Paternal soul, I vainly rescued once. It was not given me with you beside me to explore the coasts and plains of Italy, nor to discover, whatever it may be, Ausonian Tiber. It's a general term for Italy. So far he had proceeded in his speech, when from the depths of the mound and shrine a snake came huge and undulant with seven coils, enveloping the barrow peaceably and gliding on amid the altars. Azure, that means beautiful color of blue, azure flecks mottled his back, a dappled sheen of gold set all his scales ablaze. And what was it like? As when a rainbow on the clouds facing the sun throws out a thousand colors. Aeneas paused, amazed and silent, while deliberately the snake's long column wound among the bowls and polished cups, browsing the festal dishes, and from the altars where he fed again slid harmlessly to earth below the tomb. Now all the more intent, the celebrant took up again his father's ritual. So that was supposed to be a good sign. Uncertain whether he should think the snake the local god, the genius of the place, or the attendant spirit of his father, he sacrificed a pair of sheep, a pair of swine, a pair of heifers with black hides, then poured out shallow bowls of wine and called the ghost of great Anchises, that's his father, the death shade, released from Acheron, that's the river in the underworld. Then his companions, each to his capacity, brought in their own glad offerings. They piled the altars, knifed the beasts, placed cauldrons on the fires, and at their ease upon the grass, raked up live coals under the spits to broil the flesh. In due course of time, the awaited day, the shining sun's team brought a ninth and cloudless dawn, so they've had 9 days to prepare. Acestes' influence roused the neighboring folk, and now in happy groups they thronged the shore. Line 145. Thronged the shore to see Aeneas' men, or to compete. But first the prizes were set out in view midfield. Blessed tripods, fresh green crowns and palms, rewards for winners, armors too, and robes infused with crimson dye, gold bars and silver. Next, from a central eminence, a trumpet sang out for the opening of the games. Do, 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 do. The well-matched entrants in the first event were heavy-oared ships, four from the whole fleet. Menestus, eager oarsman, drove the sea beast. Menestus of Italy he soon would be, from whose name came the clan of Memnius. Then Gaius captained the Chimera, huge in length and weight, big as a town afloat, with which Dardan oarsmen in three tiers drove onward, surging together at three banks of oars. Then he for whom the Sergian house was named, Sergestus, rode the great centaur. Cloanthus, from whom your family came, Roman Cloanthus, rode in the sea blue Scylla. So now, people listening to Virgil's story are hearing the names of these boats and the guys leading the boats, and it's all of their ancestors. Out at sea, well off the foaming beach, there's a rock submerged and beaten by high seas, at times when northwest winds in winter hide the stars. But in calm weather, it stands quietly above the unmoving water, a level perch and happy, sunning place for gulls. Aeneas made a green goal here with an ilex bough. So he takes an ilex bough and he puts it out on that rock, and that's their goal. They have to get to that rock in this race. Wishing, well marked for sailors in his charge, the point where they should turn and then double back on the long course. Now they drew lots for places, captains erect upon the sterns, their gold and splendid crimson gleaming far around. The crews, for their part, garlanded with poplar bare to the waist, glistening with rubbing oil, well settled on their planks, reaching ahead to our oar hafts, listening hard for the starting call. Throbbing excitement seemed to void their hearts, all beating high, an appetite for glory. Then, as the brilliant trumpet gave its note, they all surged forward from the starting line. No lagging. Heaven echoed shouts and channels under the crewmen's pulling turned to foam. Abreast, they cleft their furrows, all the sea, torn up by oar strokes and the biting prows. What was it like as they took off on their race? The racing cars in a two-horse chariot race are not so headlong to consume the field once they have left the barriers, not though the charioteers shake out the rippling reins to give head to the teams and hang above them, bent to the whip. Then, with applause and cheers and partisan shouts, the wooded landscape rang. The shores and bay rolled the sound back and forth, and the reverberant hills gave back the din. Amid the turbulence, the leader now, racing ahead at the very start, so this is like a race commentary, was Gaius. Close on him came Cloanthus, better served by oarsmen, but his ship's weight slowed him up. Behind them, at an equal interval, the sea beast and the centaur vied for the third. And now the sea beast had it, now the mighty centaur took the lead, now both together, prows on a line, with their long keels plowed up the salt sea water. As they all came near the offshore rock, the halfway mark, the leader, Gaius, hailed Menoetes at the tiller. "Why keep so far to starboard, man? This way. Hug shore, making the turn. What if the oar blades graze the rock to port? Let others sheer off wide to seaward." Heedless in his fear of a hidden ledge, Menoetes swung the prow toward the open sea, and Gaius again cried out, "Now why bear off? Stick to the rocks, Menoetes." And at that instant, looking back, he saw Cloanthus just behind on the inner track. Between the ship of Gaius and the rocks, he shaved his way to port, then suddenly shot past him at the turn and got away into safe water, leaving the mark behind. Young Gaius flared up now, ablaze to the bottom of his soul with indignation because he got tricked, and tears wetted his cheeks. Without a thought for dignity or the safety of his crew, he tossed cautious Menoetes overboard into the sea. Then he himself as steerman, he just threw his man overboard. Then he himself as his steerman took the tiller, and his captain cheered his oarsman as he swung the rudder over, heading for shore. When heavy old Menoetes slowly at last emerged from the sea bottom, drenched and streaming, up he climbed and sat atop the dry ledge. Trojans had laughed to see his plunge, his swimming, and now laughed again as he coughed up seawater from his chest. To the two behind, to Mnestheus and Sergestius, the happy thought had come of passing Gaius. Now he had lost speed, and Sergestus led, nearing the rock, though not by a full boat length. For Sea Beast, by her prow, came up alongside. Menestheus, on his catwalk fore and aft between the oarsmen, urged them on. "Now pull, pull for it! Great Hector's companions in arms, chosen in Troy's last hour for my crew, now bring to bear the strength and nerve you showed in Galilean Syrtes in the Ionian Sea and the assaulting waves off Mela. Now for the first place, not for the victory. Now am I, Menestheus, contending, though I wish. But let the winners be your choices, Neptune, only to come in last. Oh, that's shameful. Fellows, win just this. Keep us from that disgrace. Don't let us be last." They stretched ahead for strokes and pulled their hearts out, making the beaked hull shake at every stroke, and sheets of sea were yanked, it seemed, from under them. Panting racked them dry-mouthed, and the sweat ran down in streams. But actually, chance brought them the wished-for glory. As Sergestus, in his wild zeal, entered the danger zone and turned his prow in toward the rock, his luck failed, and he struck on an outlying reef. A grinding blow, oars shivered, hitting rock, and the hull hung tipped up where it had went aground. With a loud shout, the sailors heaved together, backing water, then brought boat hooks out and pikes, retrieving cracked oars from the sea. Menestheus, meanwhile, more ardent for his luck, was with his fast oars in line, the wind behind him, took the shoreward leg through open water. As a wild dove, what was it like? As a wild dove, when startled into flight, beats her affrighted way over the fields, a dove whose coat and tender nestlings lie in a rocky cranny, with fast clapping wings, but soon in quiet air, goes floating high with wings extended motionless, just so, Menestheus, just so the sea beast cleft the sea, so it like cut apart the sea, running for the home stretch, and just so she glided home, glided, borne by her own impetus. Sergestus was the first she left behind, pitted against the ledge in shallow water with pointless cries for help, learning the trick of boat racing with broken oars. Ahead, the sea beast closed with Gaius's huge chimera that soon, for lack of helmsmen, fell away. Now in the home stretch, only one was left, Cloanthus. In his track, with might and main, Menestheus pressed on, and now the shouts from shore grew twice as loud, and all the watching crowd cheered for Menestheus, filling the air with a din. One crew fought off the shame of losing honor. Theirs already, glory won. They'd give their lives for fame. but luck empowered the others, who felt that they could do it, and so could. Their prows now, even, they were close indeed to winning, had Cloanthus not stretched out his hands to seaward, and in bursts of prayer called on the gods to hear his vows. O gods, whose power is in the deep sea, and whose waves I am racing over, I shall place with joy a snow-white bull before your altars, here upon this shore, in payment of my vow, and fling the parts into the sea, and pour a stream of wine. Under the depth of water, all the Nereids, Phorcus's company, and virgin Panopea, heard his prayer, and Father Portunus, the harbor god, with his great hand, impelled the skill onward. Swifter than a gust out of the east, or arrow on the wing, she ran for land, and took her place in the deep harbor. Then, when all were called together, Anchises' son, Aeneas, proclaimed by the loud crier Cloanthus, winner, and veiled his temples with green bay. Moreover, so that he got a wreath on his head. Moreover, to each contending ship he gave a choice of bullocks, three to each, with wine and one great bar of silver to be borne away. Additional rewards went to the captains: a cloak woven with gold thread for the winner, bordered with a meander's double line of Melibean crimson. Pictured there the royal boy amid the boughs of Ida, running with javelin that began Ganymede, tiring out swift deer, so lifelike in the chase he seemed to pant. Then Jove's big bird, his weapon carrier, his eagle, whisked him aloft from Ida in his talons. This is all embroidered on the garment. While aged guardians held out their hands to heaven in vain, and wild hounds barked at air, to him whose valor won him second place, a triple shirt of mail, close wrought with links of polished gold, so chainmail, a trophy of Aeneas' victory over Demoleus near the river Simois under Troy's high wall. This shirt Aeneas gave to Mnestheus as an honor and as protection in the wars to come. Phegeus and Sagaris, his body servants, could barely carry all its folds on shoulders braced for it, though in other days Demoleus, in this shirt and on the run, had harried straggling Trojans. The third prize Aeneas gave was a pair of brazen cauldrons and silver cups embossed in high relief. All now rewarded, proud of their rich things, beribboned, garlanded, they were going off, when back from the rude rock, barely dislodged by every skill, limping with missing oars on one oar bank, comedian Sergestius brought his long craft ingloriously in. Often you'll see a snake. What was it like when this one slow boat finally got in? Often you'll see a snake on a high road. A fellowed wheel has run obliquely over, or a pedestrian with a heavy stone has torn and left half dead. To get away, it sets in motion its long coils, in part still dangerous with blazing eyes and rearing hissing head, in part immobilized by the crippling wound, writhing upon itself, so sluggish under oars, the ship moved on. So it was just like a broken snake. But then she hoisted sail and entered harbor under full sail. Glad for the rescued ship and crew, Aeneas gave the promised gift, a slave woman who knew Minerva's craft, so a woman who knows Athena's craft, which means weaving, the Cretan Pholoe with nursing twins. Now that the ship race had been run, Aeneas walked to a grassy field, line 370, that wooded hills curved all around, a vale and an arena. There, with a crowd of thousands, the great captain betook himself and took a central place, a seat on a platform. Now he called on those whom hope for gain led to compete in running, and set out prizes for them. From all sides they came up, Teucrians with Cilicians mixed, Nisus and Euryalus in the lead, Euryalus, exceptional for beauty and blooms of youth, whom Nisus dearly loved. Next came Diores of the royal line of Priam. Then together Salius and Patron, this one an Arcanian, the other from Arcadia, a Tegan. Then two Cilicians, Helemus and Panopes, men of the woods, henchmen of old Acestes, the king, and many more whose names are in the dark. Aeneas spoke among them. Be aware of this now. Bear it haply in mind. No one goes off without a gift from me. Two Cretan arrows shod in polished steel and a double-bladed axe inlaid in silver await each one of you, the same reward. Then prizes go to the first three finishers with pale green olive garlands. He who wins will get a horse, fully caparisoned, the runner-up, an Amazonian quiver full of Thracian arrows, and a strap of broad gold buckled with a well-cut gem. As for the third-place winner, let him go contented with this Argive helm. Gets a Greek helmet. At this, they towed the line, and when they heard the signal suddenly given, broke from the starting point and made off on the track like an outriding rack of storm cloud. As they marked the finish, Nisus flashed out, sprinting into the lead, faster than gale wind or a bolt of thunder. After him, but far behind, came Cilicus, and under Cilicus, by a space, Euryalus, Helemus next. But close upon him, look, Diores in his flight matched stride with stride. Nearing his shoulder, if more track remained, he would have passed him or come up abreast in a dead heat. But in the home stretch now, the tired men were making for the finish when Nisus stumbled by bad luck in gore, a slippery place where beasts had been cut down, and blood gushed on the turf soaking the grass. Oh, bummer, he tripped in the blood. Elated with the race as good as won, he staggered there and could not hold his feet on the trodden ground, but pitched in it headlong into the mire and blood offerings. Line 425. Though beaten, this man did not forget Euryalus, his beloved, but surging from the spot of slipperiness, he tripped up Salius, and he in turn went tumbling head over heels to lie flat as Euryalus flashed by his friend's help, running to win first place amid applause and cheers. Then Helymus came in, and then Diores, third place now. At this point, the whole banked assemblage rang with Salius's clamor, facing the front row elders, for the honor stolen from him by a foul. The crowd's support and his own quiet tears were in Euryalus's favor, prowess even more winning for a handsome form. Diores backed him with loud protestations, having won third place all in vain if the first prize went back to Salius. Then Father Leonius says, "Your prizes stand as they are, young fellows. There will be no change by anyone in the winning order. Let me console a blameless friend's bad luck." With this, he gave a Galatean lion's hide with shaggy mane and gilded claws to Salius. Nisus now said, "If losers get rewards as great as that, if you console a fall, what proper gift will you give Nisus then? First prize, the crown, is what I earned by rights, had fortune not opposed me, taken me out as it did Salius." While he spoke, he showed his face and body all befouled with mire. Smiling at Nisus, Father Leonius ordered a shield brought out, a Didionmian's work, removed once by Danaans from a portal sacred to Neptune. This exceptional prize he gave to the conspicuous runner. After the races, line 465, after the races had been held and prizes given, "Now," said Aeneas, "anyone who has a fighting heart and fortitude, step forward. Put up your hands for the encasing hide." He set a double prize then for the boxing, a bullock for the winter, dressed with gold and snowy wool, a sword and a choice helm as comfort for the beaten man. Straightway, without an instant's pause in his huge power, Dares got up amid the murmurous crowd, the one who had held his ground with Paris, the man, too, who knocked out the champion Butes beside the burial mound where Hector lies. Butes, a giant boxer, bragged of coming from the Berbician tribe of Amycus, but Dares stretched him half dead in the sand. So powerful, the man reared up his head for combat, showed his shoulders' breadth, his reach with left and right, threw punches at the air. Who would fight him? Among all those men, not one dared put the leather on their hands instead of boxing gloves. Thinking all had withdrawn, yielding the prize, he took his stance before Aeneas's feet and made no bones of grasping the bull's horn in his left hand and saying, "Son of the goddess," talking to Aeneas, "if no one dares commit himself to boxing, how long must I stand here? How long may I properly be kept waiting? Say the word, and I lead off the prize." Then all the Dardanans murmured, "Let the man have what was promised." Acestes, though, had hard words for Entellus, sitting beside him on a couch of turf. "Entellus, what price now that in the old days you were the strongest fighting man? Will you sit here so meek and let a prize like that be carried off without a fight? Where now is our god, Eryx, whom you call your teacher, but let down in the end? What of your fame throughout all Trinacria, and the booty hung about your hall?" Entellus softly answered, "Not that love of honor or appetite for glory is given away, beaten by fear. I'm slowed with age. My blood runs feebly now without heat, and my strength is spent, my body muscle-bound. Had I that youth again that I once had, and this arrogant fellow counts on, I would need no setting on, no prize, no pretty steer to make me meet him. Gifts don't concern me." After saying this, he tossed into the ring a pair of gauntlets, monstrously heavy, which the fighter, Eryx, used to bind on his forearms and hands, hard rawhide, and the crowd looked on amazed. So huge they were, of seven oxhides, barred with lead and iron sewn to stiffen them. Dares himself stared more than anyone and moved away, reluctant for a bout. Meanwhile, Anchises, great-souled son, picked up and tried the gauntlets, so Aeneas tries them on, turning their rolled-up weight this way and that. The veteran Entellus now spoke up with a deep voice. "What, then, if anyone has seen Hercules' gloves and the grim fight here on this very shore? These were the armor worn by your own brother Eryx. Even now you see them stained with blood and spattered brains. In these at last he faced the great Alcides, that be Heracles. And in these I used to fight, while hotter blood sustained me, and age had not worn out yet or scattered snow in my brows. So he has some white eyebrows. But if this Trojan, Dares, refuses our equipment, if Aeneas, in fairness, so decides, and my proponent, Acestes nods, will equalize the fight. Here I give up the oxhide gloves of Eryx. Breathe easier. Pull off your Trojan gloves. He threw the double mantle from his shoulders, bared his great arms and legs, all thew and bone, and took his stand gigantic in the arena. Now with paternal care, Anchises' son, that's Aeneas, brought gauntlets of the same weight out to tie both men's hands. Then instantly, each in his stance moved on his toes and put his fists high up in the air, holding his head well back out of the range of blows. They sparred with rights and lefts, each trying to sting the other into unguarded fighting. One had the speed of footwork and the elan of youth, the other giant mass and brawn. But his slow knees quivered and buckled. Painful gasping shook him, huge as he was. Often they punched and missed. Often they hit, thudding on flanks and ribs or making chests resound. Then flurrying punches pummeled ears and temples, and their jaws would crunch at every solid blow. Entellus gravely stood at the same unshifting stance, watchful to roll with punches or to slip them. Dares, like one assaulting a tall city or laying siege to a stronghold on a height, tried this approach, then that. Explored the ground on all sides cleverly, came on, came in from various angles, all to no avail. Then surging up, Entellus poised his right and threw it, but the other in his quickness saw the blow descending and just in time slipped out from under. All Entellus's force bent spent on air, by his own impetus the mighty man fell mightily to earth. As ponderously as from time to time, As from time to time, a hollow and uprooted pine will fall on Eurynthemis or on the range of Ida. Teucrians and Sicilians in their rivalry rose together as a shout went up, and running out, Acestes was the first to help the old man, his contemporary, up from the ground. Now, neither hurt or slowed or shaken by the fall, the fighting man returned to combat hotter than before, his power excited by his anger. Shame aroused him, too, and his own sense of manhood, so that he went for Dares, driving him headlong over the ring, redoubling cuffs with right and left alike. No pause, no rest, as thick and fast as hail, drumming on roofs in a big storm where the old... What was it like? It was like the drumming on the roofs in a big storm where the old hero's blows, with both hands battering and spinning Dares. Fatherly Aeneas would not sit by while this fury went further. So berserk Entellus was in the rancor of his soul, he stopped the fight and saved bone-weary Dares, saying to comfort him, "A poor fellow! How could rashness take you this way? Don't you feel a force now more than mortal is against you?" So, you know, when you lose in a competition, it's because the gods are against you. It's not your own fault. "Don't you feel a force now more than mortal is against you?" Line 605. "And heaven's will has changed? We'll bow to that." So speaking loudly, he broke off the battle, and loyal shipmates took Dares in hand, weak-kneed, his head wobbling from side to side, spitting out teeth mixed in with gobs of blood. They led him to the ships, and then recalled, received the helm and sword, leaving the palm and bullocks for Entellus. The old champion, glorying in his courage and his prize, spoke out, "Son of the goddess, Teucrians all," so talking to Aeneas and all the Trojans, "now see what power was in me in my prime, and see the death from which you rescued Dares." So the old guy says, "Oh, it's good you stopped the fight because you rescued the young kid from death." He set himself to face the bull that stood there, prize of the battle, then drew back his right and from his full height lashed his hard glove out between the horns. The impact smashed the skull and fragmented the brains. So there's a bull there that he gets, and he just smashes it with his hard glove. The impact smashed the skull and framed it at the brains. Down went the ox, a quiver, to sprawl dying on the ground. The man stood over it and in deep tones proclaimed, "Here is a better life in place of Dares, Eryx. Here I lay down my gauntlets and my art." So he kills the big ox just standing there with one blow and says, "Now I'm done boxing forever." Immediately after this, Aeneas invited all so minded to contend with speeding arrows, and he set the prizes. A mast out of Cerastus's ship he raised with his own giant hand, and at the top tethered a dove upon a cord as target for them to shoot at. So he catches a dove, he ties a string to it, and puts it on the top of this ship mast, and they have this moving flying target they have to shoot at for archery. When they gathered around, a bronze helm took their lots. First shaken out, so they put all the lots in a helmet and shake them out. First shaken out and greeted by his partisans with cheers was Hippocoon, son of Hyrcatus, then Menesthus, second-place winner in the ship race, wearing his olive garland, and the third was Eurytion, brother you, illustrious Pandarus, who in another day, when given command to break the truce, led off with a bow-bent arrow shot amid the Achaeans. The last one out, deep in the helm, Acestes, he too ventured to try the young men's feet. Now, with stout arms, they flexed their bows, each man hefting his own before him, and then drew their shafts from quivers, right across the sky as the bowstring twanged. The first winged arrow, shot by the son of Hyrtacus, whipped through the air to strike and then stay fixed in the mast's timber. The long pole trembled and the terrified bird fluttered, and all the place rang with applause. Now Menestheus took his eager stand, bow bent, and aimed his gaze and full-drawn arrow high, but by hard luck he missed the bird herself. His steel point cut the flaxen cord by which, tied to her foot, the bird hung from the mast. Away she soared into the south wind, white against dark clouds. In a flash, Eurytion, so the bird just got away, Eurytion, long ready with his bow bent, arrow drawn, and whispering to his archer brother's shade, as he tracked the dove, delighting in open sky with clapping wings, now put his arrow through her under a black cloud. Down she plummeted, so he, even though the dove was flying away, he got the dove. Down she plummeted and left her life in the upper air of stars, but brought down with her the transfixing shaft. Only Acestes now remained, although the prize escaped him. Still he bent his bow and shot into the air, showing them all his old-time archer's power and bow that sang. But here before their startled eyes appeared an omen, ooh, of great import. Afterward, mighty events made it all clear, and poets far in the future fabled it in awe. The arrow flying in thin cloud caught fire and left a track of flame until, burnt out, it vanished in the wind as shooting stars. How did it vanish? As shooting stars will often slip away in the sky, trailing their blown hair, everyone stood still and thunderstruck with prayer to heaven's powers, Trinicians and Teucrians alike. Aeneas's great soul embraced the sign, embraced joyous Acestes, loaded him with handsome gifts and said, "Here, take them, father. You are the one great king of Olympus, wished by these auspices to be distinguished apart from others. You shall have this gift that in his old age had been Anchises' own, a mixing bowl engraved that Cisseus of Thrace once gave my father, a princely thing, to keep as a reminder and pledge of love." With this he bound Acestes' brows with laurel, gave him a laurel wreath, proclaiming him the winner before all, line 695. Preferment never grudged by that good fellow Eurytion, although he alone had brought the dove down from the sky. The third-place winner, he who had cut the cord, came forward next for his reward, and last came he who fixed his arrow in the timber of the mast. But even before the finish of this contest, Aeneas called aside Epitides, bodyguard and companion of young Iulus, and spoke into his ear, "Go out and tell Ascanius, if he has the boy's troop ready, here along with him and his maneuvers planned for the horses, tell him to lead them on for grandfather, these squadrons, and to let himself in, be seen in arms." So this is now, this part of the Aeneid we call the boy parade. This is line 712 forward. So Aeneas just said, go tell my little boy Ascanius, if he's got all the boy's troops ready, they're going to ride out here and perform this little parade for in memory of his father Ascanius. Aeneas now commanded the whole crowd to withdraw from the long track and open up the playing field. Then came the riders, boys in even ranks, all shining before their parents' eyes, all mounts in hand, and as they passed, admiring murmurs rose from men of Sicily and men of Troy. The troopers, because they're on Sicily, okay, Trojans and Sicilians, the troopers had their hair smartly pressed down by well-trimmed wreaths. Each had a pair of lances made of cornel tipped with steel. Some shoulders bore glossy quivers. All wore twisted gold in a pliant necklace on the upper chest. There were three squadrons, three commanders weaving right and left. Now, these are all boys. Behind each one, there came two files of six boy riders in open column, bright in the sun, and a trainer to each column. Number one squadron gloried in its leader, little Priam, who bore his grandsire's name. Your noble son, Polites, and a destined sire of Italians, riding a Thracian mount with dappling of white, white pasterns, and upon his haughty brow a snow-white blaze. Ates had command of the second squadron, from whom the Latin Atti have their name. Small Ates, cherished boy to boy, by Iulus, so his best friend. Third and last, and handsomest of all, came Iulus. So this is Aeneas' son. He's riding a Sidonian mount. Now, Now, remember that Dido is from Sidon? So he's riding the horse that Dido gave him. This is what little Ulius Ascanius is riding. Came Ulius riding a Sidonian mount, given him by that glowing beauty Dido, to be a keepsake and a pledge of love. The other troopers rode Sicilian horses of old Acestes. Dardans with applause now greeted the shy boys and loved their show, marking in each the features of his forebears. After the troop had circled the assembly before their family's eyes, Epitides, from the wings, shouted an order prearranged and cracked his whip. The column split apart as files in the three squadrons, all in line, turned away, cantering left and right. Recalled, they wheeled and dipped their lances for a charge. So it's all in syncretism, all this parade stuff. They entered them then on parades and counter-parades, the two detachments matched in the arena, winding in and out of one another, and whipped into sham cavalry skirmishes, so they pretend to fight, but it's all been arranged ahead of time, by bearing backs in flight, then whirling round with leveled points, then patching up a truce and riding side by side. So intricate in ancient times on mountainous Crete, they say the labyrinth between walls in the dark ran crisscross a bewildering thousand ways devised by the guile, a maze insoluble, breaking down every clue to the way out. So intricate the drill of the Trojan boys, who won the patterns of their pacing horses, figured in sport, retreats, and skirmishes like dolphins in the drenching sea. So that's how together they were. Carpathian or Libyan, that shear through waves and play. This mode of drill, this mimicry of war, so this is a military style drill. Like, and it's as though this is the first boy parade, but it really is setting the pattern, so Virgil says, because in Virgil's time, they do this same type of parade. So Virgil is giving it a history that will go back 1,000 years. This mode of drill, this mimicry of war, Ascanius brought back in our first years when he walled Alba Longa. So now you know that Ascanius is going to build the walls of a city he'll call Alba Longa when he grows up. And he taught the ancient Latins to perform the drill as he had done with other Trojan boys. The Albans, the people from Alba Longa, taught their children, and in turn, great Rome took up this glory of the founders. The boys are called Troy now, and the whole troop Trojan. Rites for Aeneas' father had reached this point, when fortune now first altered and betrayed them. While they were honoring the tomb with games, Saturnian Juno sent her Iris, her messenger, down from heaven exhaling winds to waft her far to the Trojan fleet. Juno had plans afoot, her ancient rancor not yet satisfied. So Juno, just as in the beginning of the book, she's still mad. So Iris glided on the colored rainbow, seen by none, swift goddess, on her way. She sighted the great crowd, then scanned the shore, saw ports deserted and ships unattended, but on a desolate beach apart, the women wept for Anchises lost as they gazed out in tears at the unfathomable sea. How many waves remain for us to cross? How broad a sea, though we are weary, weary. So the men are all having their Olympic-style games, and the women are out at the shore. The boats are unprotected, and they're all just longing, looking out, saying, oh my goodness, do we have to get on those boats again? All had one thing to say. A town and home were what they dreamed of, sick of toil at sea. Taking her cue, darting into their midst, adept at doing ill, so Iris is really good at doing bad things, Iris put off her aspect of a goddess and her gown to take the form of aged Beroe. So this is Iris joining the women very discreetly, and Beroe is, I think, Anchises' nurse. It's somebody's aged nurse, wife of the Temerian Dorcas, blessed with noble birth, a name at Troy, and children. In this guise, she advanced among the mothers. Miserable women that we are, she said, whom no Achaean hand dragged out to death under the walls of our old fatherland. Unlucky nation, for what final blow is fortune keeping you alive? We've seen the seventh summer since the fall of Troy, and all these years we've been driven on by land and sea, by hostile rocks and stars, to measure the great water in our quest for Italy, and Italy that recedes while we endure the roll of the sea swell. Here is the land of Eryx, our old brother. Here's our host Acestes, who prevents our building here a town for town dwellers. Country of our fathers, dear hearth guards, rescued from the enemy to no end, will never a wall be called the wall of Troy? Shall I not see on earth Simois and Xanthus, Hector's rivers? Come on now, all of you, set fire to these infernal ships with me. So the old woman, Iris, is going to set fire to these ships. I dreamed the clairvoyant Cassandra came with burning torches, offering them, saying, ooh, here you may look for Troy. Your home is here. Why wait? High time we acted on such portents. See there, Neptune's four altar flames. The god has fire for us. The god will give us courage. Urging them on, she, and this is Iris, picked a dangerous brand, a brand of fire, lifted it high and swept it into the flame and threw it. Taken by surprise, the women stood bewildered. Then one from the crowd, the eldest, Prigo, a royal governess to Priam's many sons, cried, do not take her for Bere. That's not she, the Rutean. So this old woman says, it's not Bere, it's goddess. Wife of Doryclus, mothers, just observe what traits she has of more than mortal beauty. Her blazing eyes, her audacity, her face, her voice, her stride. I tell you, I myself left Bere just now, and she is ill, vexed too that she alone missed our observance and paid no tribute to Anchises. Thus Pergo reported to them. Women of Troy, they looked now toward the ship's uncertainty with animosity, half in unhappy love of landscapes there before them, half still bound to fated realms, calling them onward, and the goddess on strong wings went up to the sky, so Iris flies away, traversing a great rainbow under the clouds. Now, truly wrought upon by signs and wonders, wrought to a frenzy, all cried out together, snatching up fire from hearths, despoiling altars, so they're taking fire from the altars, taking dry foliage, brush, and brands to throw, and Vulcan, the god of fire, unbridled rage. Vulcan is the god of the underworld, so I forgot his Greek name. Unbridled rage through rowing thwarts and oars and piny hulls. Courier Eumaeus brought to Anchises term in the bank theater news of ships on fire, and looking round they saw the dark smoke with soaring embers. First to act, Ascanius, as he had led his troops rejoicing, now whipped on his horse to reach the mutinous camp, and winded trainers could not hold him back. What unheard of madness, the boy shouted. Where now? Where do you intend to go? Poor miserable women of our city, not the enemy, not the Argive camp, but your own hopes are what you're burning. Look here, I'm your own Ascanius. And he hurled before their fleet his hollow helmet, put on for the sham battles. Meanwhile, in all haste, Aeneas came and the Trojan companies. But the women scattered here and there in fear, line 875, along the beaches and in the woods, wherever they could take cover in rock caves, ashamed to face the daylight, face what they had done. For now they knew their own, and their shocked hearts were free of Juno. So Juno... It was Juno who tricked them to set fire to the ships, not the women. Not on that account did fires lit by them lose power or yield to counteraction. Under wedded oak, the caulking smoldered and exuded smoke as the great sluggish heat ate into holes, and the contagion, the fire, seeped all through the body. Neither men's force nor streams of water poured prevailed on it. Now God-fearing Aeneas rent the shirt upon his shoulders. Throwing wide his hands, he begged high heaven for help. Almighty Jupiter, unless by now you loathe all Trojans to the last man, if divine kindness, shown in ancient days, can still pay heed to mortal suffering, grant that our fleet survive this fire, Father. Even now, at the last moment, save the frail affairs of Trojans from destruction. Otherwise, do what now remains to do. With your consuming bolt, with your right hand, if I deserve it, just blast me and overwhelm us. Line 900. Scarce had he spoken when a black storm broke in wild fury with spouting rain, while peals of thunder shook the lowlands and high places. Down from the whole sky the torrents came in dense murk, black as pitch out of the south, and ships were filled up, half-burnt timbers drenched, till all the fires were out, and all the hulls except for four, so four ships did not burn, delivered from the burning. Aeneas had been stunned by the mischance, and could not rest, turning this way and that within him, coping with momentous questions. Should he forget the destiny foretold and make his home in Sicily, or try again for Italy? Nautes, an older man, and one whom Pallas Tritigena, Athena Minerva, had taught his famous thoughtfulness, she gave him answers as to the meaning of the god's great wrath, or what the pattern of the fates required. Nautes addressed Aeneas to give him heart. Sir, born of an immortal, let us follow where our fates may lead, or lead us back. Whatever comes, all fortune can be mastered by endurance. You have Acestes, a Dardanian divine in lineage. Make him your counselor, congenial as he is in all your plans. So Nautes basically says to Aeneas, okay, some of the ships are burnt. Let's just leave the old ones. Let's leave the old and feeble people here. He's coming up with they said he's congenial, use his plans. And now these ships are burnt. Hand over to him the number of those they might have carried, those too weary of your great quest, your seafaring, men who have had long lives, women worn out on shipboard, feeble men afraid of danger. Set them apart and let them have their city here in this land, the tired ones, and they may, with permission, call their own town Acesta, Western Sicily. Here his old friend's plan attracted him, but still Aeneas wondered, all the more torn between anxieties of all kinds. As now, black night, borne upward in her car, possessed the sky, out of the dark, from heaven, his father's image seemed to float suddenly and speak. So now Aeneas has like a vision of his father. My son, my son, dearer to me than life while life remained, and pitted now against the fates of Troy, I come by Jove's command, who drove away the fire from your ships, being moved to pity in heaven's height at last. Obey the council, beautiful as it is, now given by Nautes. Embark for Italy, chosen men, the bravest. In Latium you must battle down in war, a hard race, hard by nature and by training. First, however, visit the underworld, the halls of Dis, whom we call Pluto in Greek. So Anchises tells Aeneas, you must visit the underworld, the halls of Dis, Hades, and through profound Avernus, come to meet me, son. Black Tartarus, with its grim realm of shades, is not my home, but radiant gatherings of godly souls I have about me in Elysium. So now we hear that Aeneas's dad is in Elysium, the good dead place. To that place the pure Sibyl, after blood of many black sheep flows out, will conduct you. Then you will hear of your whole race to come, and what walled town is given you. Farewell! Night passes midway on her wheeling course, and cruel sunrise fanned me with a breath, her laboring team exhaled. And after speaking, he faded like thin smoke into air. Aeneas cried, so soon, where to then? Must you vanish? Are you taking flight from someone? Who can forbid you to be held by me? So he called out, then turned to poke the embers, the drowsing fire on his hearth, and paid his humble duty to the Lar of Troy. And Vesta's shrine, the goddess of the hearth, with ground meal as in ritual sacrifice, and a full incense casket. Then at once he called his captains, told Acestes first of Jove's command, as taught by his dear father, and what had now stood decided in his mind. No long exchange, no dissent from Acestes. They listened, for the town, the older women, and set aside men so inclined, who felt no need to win honor. So the Greeks, of course, this is Time, they feel no need to win honor. The remainder built new thwarts, replaced burnt timbers, fitted oars and rigging, a slim band of men, but brave hearts keen for war. Meanwhile, Aeneas marked with a plow the limits of the town, and gave sites, home sites by lot. One place should be called Ilium, he decreed, one quarter Troy. Acestes, Trojan that he was, took pleasure in his new realm, proclaiming an assembly and giving laws to the Senate now convoked. Then on Mount Eryx's height a shrine was built, hard by the stars, to Venus of Idalia. So this is Aphrodite, of course, and this is, she's worshipped in Cyprus. And round about Anchises' tomb, they left a hollowed grove with an attendant priest. 9 days the people feasted, and the altars fumed with offerings. Light airs lulled the sea, and blowing often from the south renewed their call to cross the main. A sound of weeping rose on the curving shore, as by night and then a day, embracing, they postponed it. Even those men to whom the sea's face had seemed harsh, its very name intolerable, now desired to go. Awe and bear all exiles' toil. Aeneas spoke to them with kindness and commended them in tears to their blood brother Acestes. He decreed, and that's the king of Sicily, he decreed 3 calves be slain to Eryx and a lamb to the storm winds. Cables then were cast off as he himself, wearing an olive garland, standing upon the prow apart, held out the shallow cup and flung the vitals down into the salt surf, then poured out the wine. Wind coming up astern blew in their wake as crewmen struck their oars into the swell and swept a path over the sea. But now, line 1010, but now, beset with worries, Venus turned to Neptune, unfolding from her heart complaints and plea. Juno's anger and her implacable heart drive me to prayers beneath my dignity. No length of time, no piety affects her, unspoken in will by Jove's commands or fate. She never holds her peace. To have devoured a city from the heart of Phrygia's people in her vile hatred, this was not enough, nor to have dragged the remnant left from Troy through all harassment. Now she harries still Troy's bones and ashes. She alone may know the cause of such madness. You yourself are witness to the giant storm she roused not long ago in the Sea of Libya, mixing sea and sky with hurricane winds of Aeolus her standby, though in vain, and all this dared in your domain. But look at her new crime. So she's saying Juno made the women burn their ships. So Venus is complaining to her dad. But look at her new crime, how she egged on the Trojan women to their foul ship burning, making the Trojans, for that loss of ships, forsake their own folk in a strange country. But as to what comes next, I beg you, let them safely entrust their sailing ships to you across the water. Let them reach that stream, Laurentine Tiber. The Tiber is the river in Rome. If one may concede these favors, if the Parcae, the Fates, grant their city. The son of Saturn, tamer of the deep, replied. So Saturn, Zeus, replies, Cythera, or Venus Aphrodite, you have every right to trust my kingdom. You were born from it. Then, too, I've merited your trust. So often have I repressed those mad fits and that fury of heavens and the sea. On land as well, as Xanthus and Simoeus can testify, I cared for your Aeneas. That day Achilles, hot in pursuit, pinned Trojan troops half dead with fright against their walls and killed a Myriad, making the rivers choked with corpses, groan, so Xanthus could not find his bed or send his current seaward. Then, as Aeneas fought against the odds, against the frown of heaven, the mighty son of Peleus, Achilles, it was I who caught and saved him in a sack of cloud. Lust though I did to cast down walls, I built with my own hands walls of oath-breaking Troy. To this day my regard for him is the same. Dispel your fear. He shall, as you desire, enter Avernus' port. One shall be lost, but only one to look for, lost at sea. One life given for many. So only one guy is going to be lost. He assured and cheered the goddess in this way, then yoked his team with gold, fitted the foaming bits in their wild mouths, let the reins run free, flying on the crests in his blue car. So there goes the Poseidon, son of Saturn, tamer of the deep. So the son of Saturn, that is Poseidon. That was his speech to Aphrodite Venus. So he's going off in his chariot, beautiful imagery here, in his blue car. Waves calmed and quieted, the long sea swell smoothed out under his thundering axle tree, and storm clouds thinned away in heaven's vast air. Now came the diverse shapes of his companions, enormous whales and Glaucus's hoary troop, Palaemon, son of Ino, arrowy Tritons, Phorcus's whole host, Thetis, and Melite and virgin Panoply on the left, Naissi, Spio, Thalea, Camosity. So he sees all these sea people. Aeneas sees all these sea people with Poseidon. The joys of the fair weather filled in turn Aeneas's attentive heart. Up with the masts, he ordered. Sails unfurled from the yard arms. The seamen as one man hauled on the sheets, now port, now starboard, set the bellying canvas evenly to the wind and took the braces, veering this way and that, yard arms aloft until the freshening stern winds filled the sails and bore them onward. On the leading ship, Palinurus guided the close formation, and all orders to set course by him. Now dewy night had touched her midway mark on nearly, and the crews, relaxed in peace on their hard-rowing benches, took their rest when Somnus, who is the god of sleep, okay, Somnus, like insomnia is when you can't sleep, when Somnus, gliding softly toward the stars, put the night air aside, parted the darkness, Palinurus, in quest of you. He brought bad dreams to you in all your guiltlessness. Upon the high poop deck the god sat down in Phorbas's guide and said, Son of Eosius, that's Palinurus, the very sea itself moves the ships onward. There's a steady breeze. The hour for rest has come. Put down your head and steal a respite for your tired eyes. I'll man your tiller for a while. But Palinurus barely looked around and said, he's the chief Trojan, right? But Forget my good sense for this peaceful face the sea puts on, the calm swell. Put my trust in that capricious monster, or hand over Aeneas to the tricky winds when I've been deceived so often by clear weather? With this response, he held fast to the helm and would not give it up, but kept his eyes upon the seas, the stars. Now see the god, his bow adrip with Lethe's dew, and slumberous with Stygian power, giving it a shake over the pilot's temples to unfix, though he fought it, both his swimming eyes. His unexpected drowse barely began. Somnus leaned over him and flung him down in the clear water, breaking off with him a segment of the stern and steering oar. Head first, he went down, calling in vain on friends. So the god of sleep put Palinurus to sleep, and then, you know, throws him overboard. The god himself took flight into thin air, but still the fleet ran safely on its course, serene in Father Neptune's promises. Borne onward, now it neared the Siren's reef, that old-time peril, white with many bones, now loud far off with trample of surf on rock. Here the commander felt a loss of way, and his ship's head swung off, lacking a helmsman, and he himself took over, holding course in the night waves. Hard hit by his friend's fate, and sighing bitterly, he said, "For counting over much on a calm world, Palinurus, you must lie naked on some unknown shore." So Palinurus, for his disbelief, gets thrown overboard, and he's gone. End of book 5.